This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 11th of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. This is Emma Nelson. On today's show, end the gambling and reach a deal. The EU tells Greece to stop playing games with its debt. We'll discuss the warnings issued to Alexis Tsipras and his government. And as the IMF walks out of talks, we'll wonder whether some are now past caring. We'll discuss that and the rest of the day's big stories with my studio guests Oscar Guardioli Rivera and Quentin Peel, including a leap for freedom of speech, but a blow for good writing. Brazil lifts its ban on the unauthorised biography. And while the EU plucks migrants from the Med, we talk about Tunisia and its efforts to save the thousands trying to flee to Europe. And finally,
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely. I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house. I must apologise for not being here to greet you personally, but I trust that you have found everything you needed.
The man who made horror truly horrifying and all with an eyebrow. We discuss the effect on horror films and indeed cinema as a whole of Christopher Lee. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London, and Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and regular contributor to the Financial Times. Welcome, gentlemen, to the studio. So has patience run out for Alexis Tsipras? Both the President of the EU Council and the President of the European Council have directly and indeed indirectly told Greece to stop delaying over repaying its debt. The day is coming, I'm afraid, that someone says the game is over, Donald Tusk said last night. And after lunch today, Jean-Claude Juncker echoed Mr. Tusk's words, but then promised to stay in touch with Prime Minister Tsipras. All seemed to be going reasonably well, and then words were replaced by deeds, as a mere 2 hours ago, the IMF suddenly withdrew its team from the negotiations. Quentin, let us begin with you. We've seen Greece play this game of bravado. One could argue that it has been saying, we are looking for a deal, we are positive, we are close to a deal. And yet, it seems that time is up for that game now, doesn't it?
I think it certainly sounds like that. I mean, my Financial Times colleague in Brussels sent a message out saying we've gone from the cusp of a deal to the cusp of disaster within a week. It did look like things were moving, like we were almost there, and yet it doesn't. And I think that the worrying thing is that Alexis Tsipras seems to perhaps have miscalculated how much time he still had to play the brinkmanship game. And maybe everybody's miscalculated the problem of both persuading the parties, the parliament in Greece to go along with it. But also, it's not just Germany, it's all the countries in the Eurozone, and that was always the difficulty.
Oscar, I mean, the behaviour of Greece in terms of the way it has been very expertly avoiding paying off its debt. I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of the way that it has been behaving faced with a much bigger body, well, several bodies, all of whom it owes an awful lot, owes an awful lot of money to?
There are far too many variables here. Some of them are purely economics. Most of them are political. We must remember that this kind of debt is mainly a political issue, which explains some of the staunch opposition in Europe. I mean, if you take, for instance, the Spanish government, for them, this is a matter of life and death, not because they are incredibly concerned about the debt as such, but rather what would happen in the coming elections in November. They face Podemos, a party that runs a similar platform to that of Syriza. And of course, they do not want Spanish voters to see Syriza getting away with it. On the other hand, there is the Greek people, and that, to me, is the most important issue. Internally, what has happened in Greece is a terrible tragedy, a continuing tragedy. And I think that all the parties involved must begin to think not just about what the debt means in economic terms, but also in terms of human costs. And perhaps there we can find some common ground.
What Oscar talks about there is obviously this difficult situation that Alexis Tsipras finds himself in. I think someone earlier on this week described it as he's having to ride two horses at the same time. Namely, he has this obligation and this ostensible willingness to cooperate with Europe and the IMF to get a solution so that it can save his country's skin. Yet at the same time, he was elected in on a ticket of anti-austerity, which everybody is condemning him to stick to.
It's the classic European dilemma, if you like, of having two constituencies all the time.
Yes.
A national home constituency and a European constituency, where everybody else has a national constituency. And how do you play that balancing act? And in a way, the curious thing about Alexis Tsipras is a bit like David Cameron. He's sort of rushing to his European partner saying, but I've now got a mandate, you've got to do what my voters tell you. And they're all saying, well, hang on, yeah, but we've got voters too. And that's been the balancing act that's been very, very difficult to get right. I fear that the trouble is that, at least my impression is that the lack of movement has been overwhelmingly on the Greek side. And I think there was always a willingness from certainly somebody like Angela Merkel to do a deal, provided she could come up with something that showed that Greece was moving. And the tragedy for the Greek people, and Oscar said what a human tragedy this is that all the pain has been, if you like, just the pain of cuts, without the more productive pain of actually really reforming the system. Nobody's shaken up the Greek system. I was really struck yesterday rereading what a colleague of mine wrote in 1992 about, oh my God, Greece has got to reform and shake up. It could have been written today, and that was 22 years ago, 23.
And yet, we may be confusing two very different things. Austerity on the one hand and reforms on the other. There are some reforms which are badly needed, others not so much. But perhaps part of the problem is that we have fused these two issues so that now the only path to reform seems to be austerity. And of course, that's not what the people of Greece want. It's not what the majority of the Spanish people want. And there we have a sort of clash of universalisms, the universalism of the internal electorate and then the universalism of the European project.
Of course, the link is that particularly in Greece, more so, I think, than in Spain, where the problem was the property bubble and everything associated with that. But in Greece, so much of the economy has been kept going with subsidies. And the subsidies have been based on a borrowing and a debt in the government. And that inevitably, therefore, makes austerity and reform inextricably linked.
You mentioned, though, the idea of the balancing act that is this huge problem for Greece and its European partners. But perhaps this is something, indeed, upon which the whole of Europe has been based on, is the idea that if you are going to move together as a group of member states, everybody has to give on at every single point. And this is going to be the way that Europe remains strong. Is Greece, therefore, no longer an acceptable part of Europe, given the fact that it is happy to fight so hard?
Perhaps the questions should be reversed. I mean, is the Europe of only austerity a viable common project? It seems to be the case, and of course we have also heard the opinion of Joseph Stiglitz and the signatories of the manifesto that was published the previous weekend, saying that we must be very careful not to push Greece to the brink of failure. Because among other things, if the Syriza party fails, what is waiting ahead, at the next corner is Golden Dawn, is the Front National. We're really facing a situation that may begin to look more and more like the 1930s. And I'm sure that's not the kind of Europe that we all want.
But I would disagree on one thing, that it's only a message of austerity. No, it isn't. That was the wrong message from the start, if you like. The austerity only really came in heavily because there wasn't enough reform. If there'd been more reform, there would have been need for less austerity. And that was the reform, though, are politically difficult. In Greece, those reforms do involve cutting back on the public sector.
How's austerity going to, you know, make those reforms more palatable?
No, I'm not saying it does.
If that is the case, then that is precisely the mistake.
No, and the reforms should come first.
Exactly. And you and me can agree that these two things need to be separate.
Where does the reform come from now, Quentin? It cannot be top down because Greece is kicking up hard. It cannot be from within Greece itself unless Tsipras betrays the promises that he made to his own country and betrays his party.
I think that there is a mood in Greece that says we really want, one, we want to stay inside the system. Two, we do want to create, if you like, in our country a sustainable system. We don't want the rich fat cats to carry on not paying their taxes. Unfortunately, the history of not paying taxes goes right through the system in Greece. But that's the sort of thing that has to be, if you like, popularly accepted, that people have got to accept you do pay your taxes. And it's a very long history in Greece of tax avoidance.
Well, that may be true, but we should not blame the entire Greek people for, the tax-evading habits of the few and the fat cats. So this characterization of the Greek people as, you know, tax fraudsters and, lazy coastal peoples is terribly damaging and is also very untrue. We must recognize the fact that they have worked very, very hard to precisely put together the kinds of reforms that we would like to see. But right now, Tsipras is in no position to sell to its people further austerity, further cuts, the pension scheme going out of every less than proportionate manner. And that is why the Greeks are now beginning to contemplate the possibility of, an exit from the euro, which I still believe would be disastrous, not just for the Greek, but also for Europe.
Quentin, one wonders why they haven't defaulted before now, because they miss deadlines or they push back deadlines. But at the 23rd hour, they always manage to find a little bit of surplus in a department somewhere. I mean, we've talked a lot about the fact that the Greeks are very good at hiding things, not paying taxes, and they're incredibly skilled at doing it, or they're perceived to be incredibly skilled. Is this action by the IMF this afternoon not just a complete threat of this is it, or we chuck you out if you default, that's it, you're in trouble? Is it just rather a sort of a clever move of making them stew and making them find that extra bag of money in the back cupboard?
Well, I know that the IMF spokesman has said in Washington, the IMF never leaves the table.
Yes.
But having said that, a week ago, it was Greece that was really fed up with the IMF. They said, look what's been put on the table. This stinks of the IMF. We don't like them at all. And they weren't prepared to go any way towards what the IMF was demanding, which was a significant increase in value-added tax and indeed cuts in pensions. But the problem with the pension system is Greek pensions are the same as German pensions, for goodness sake, and they don't earn the money to pay for those pensions. And they cannot carry on having a pension system as generous as Germany when the economy simply doesn't produce the income to pay for it.
The EU's Economics Commissioner Pierre Moscovici has said that no one wants Greece to leave the Eurozone. Is this a possibility now? I mean, everybody is now talking about it.
Well, most certainly, that is one of two possible scenarios in Greece. Kostas Lapavitsas, a member of parliament, has published a book with a German economist on how the so-called controlled exit would take place. But I know for certain that that's not the option that most of them would like to take. There is also the other option, the debt true commission, which has been set up by the Congress spokesperson of Syriza, Zoe Katapoulou, and there we'll see also what part of the debt is odious, what part of the debt is payable, and what part should not be paid.
It's going to be really tough if Greece actually is forced out of the euro in any way. I just imagine reintroducing the drachma or national currency, the logistical challenge that that would be, what happens in the interim when actually physically the money's not there? And who's going to actually be prepared to accept that money as having an intrinsic value? I think it's a chaotic situation we'd be facing.
Oh, this is why Stiglitz and others are right to warn all of us against such a possibility.
Well, while we let Greece stew, let us move to Brazil, a country where since 2003, if you were the subject of a biography and you didn't like what was written about you, then you had a remedy. You could get the book blocked, or indeed, if some errant copy had made it to the shops, then you could have it taken off the shelves. But the law changed on Wednesday. Oscar, explain to me why the Brazilians seem to have such a strong ability to stop nasty words being published about them. Why is this law? Why did this law exist in the first place?
Well, some people say that it's a sort of remnant from the years of the dictatorship, you know, this kind of censorship habit. But it is also the case that the law was celebrated by many celebrities, among them the, you know, the former members of the Tropicália countercultural group, who, of course, saw here an opportunity to, you know, make sure that they will be the sole owners of everything and anything that could be said about them, which is a shame. I mean, two things are important here. Biography is not a big genre in Latin America, by definition, which is a shame. We should have more biographies being written. This is, in fact, one of the reasons why not many biographies are written. So I think it's cause for celebration that we will have unauthorized biographies. After all, aren't unauthorized biographies the only interesting ones?
How much of a chilling effect do you think a law like what has just been quashed has on publishing?
I think it has a very chilling effect. I think it's gone. So I think this is absolutely wonderful that it's that it's gone. We're in a very weird situation in the world today where all social media basically is people undressing themselves in public.
And undressing others as well. They can pretty much say what they like about each other to a certain degree, because I'm not quite sure that the world's libel laws have quite caught up with it, have they?
Not at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you have this situation where everybody, and where celebrities, like the sort of people who are trying to stop themselves having biographies written in Brazil, actually were, of course, trying to be very public figures. So they wanted to have their cake and eat it. And that's, I mean, I don't want to particularly read about most of these celebrities, but I do want to read about other people. Of course, the wonderful case we had last year in Germany, where it came out that the man who was writing the authorised biography of Chancellor Helmut Kohl had fallen out with the former Chancellor. And as a result, he went and published a book based on all the unauthorised bits of their conversation. Huge law case, and actually Kohl won in the end, but it was too late. Basically, the book had been on the streets for a month.
And everyone's read it.
Everybody'd read it.
To what degree, I mean, one of the arguments put forward in the case in Brazil was that it would have an effect on other media, such as newspapers, news broadcasts and what have you, that indeed to sort of say something that isn't approved of could get you in a lot of trouble. But it's a strange thing, because of the brief encounters that I have had with Brazil and its culture, they do like a good gossip, and they love a good, you know, they love a good television soap opera. They love fantasy and they love scandal.
Oh, they love it. And I'm sure, you know, most people in Brazil were reminded that this law existed. They love it, and the publishing industry will thrive on it. And of course, it will have an effect on the other media. But to be honest, that's already there. If you watch Brazilian television, if you read the newspapers, I mean, you know, the gossip is there. The big celebrities are there. In that respect, Brazil has not been an exception. So the law was really an obstacle. In a sort of, a remnant from the past that...
degree do you think, Quentin, that the way that the world's law operates nowadays, that you actually could, if someone said something about you in a Brazilian court, you could take them to court in the United Kingdom? The world's libel system is strong enough, indeed, for Brazilian celebrities to feel somewhat protected, one would say.
Strong enough or bad enough, actually. I mean, this is a nightmare that people can come to London and sue each other because we've got ridiculously harsh libel laws, when actually their reputation barely exists in this country. So we've got all these sort of Russian oligarchs suing in the London courts about at stuff that's been published in Russia or in Ukraine. This is crazy. We've got to clamp down on
You're
that.
Nodding in agreement.
I'm in agreement. You know, these British libel laws, again, belong to the past.
It's changed, however, hasn't it? Because
it has,
needs
it has
to
changed,
have been seen
yeah.
to have been done.
The practice has changed, and yet the possibilities are still there for people who, as we just heard, have no reputation whatsoever to come and try and convince us that they do.
Excellent. The lawyers in the United Kingdom are quickly brushing up on their Portuguese, no doubt. You're listening to Midori House here. This is Emma Nelson, joined by Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Quentin Peel. We'll be back in a moment to talk about Tunisia's role in the Mediterranean migrant crisis, and we examine the influence of Christopher Lee, the man who made horror horrifying.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
It's 1921 in Madrid, 1821 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and still with me Quentin Peel and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, while the grand scale efforts of the likes of the British Navy warship HMS Bulwark have been well publicised in the continual struggle to rescue thousands of migrants from the Med, Tunisia's Navy rescued 350 migrants, including a two-month-old baby off its coast yesterday. So just how much of a problem is North Africa having, and could it do more? Could it do more in terms of joint operations efforts? Let's begin with you, Oscar. And to what degree do you think Tunisia has a problem here in terms of directly dealing with the Mediterranean migrants? Because a lot of the focus, in fact, all of the focus, has pretty much been on the way that Europe has reacted as a single body.
It is very interesting because, of course, the problem has a name. The problem is Libya. And while EU leaders are worried about the, you know, whether or not Libya will become a failed state, as far as Tunisia and the neighbors are concerned, it has become already such a thing. And that means that the borders are now much more under pressure, not just the borders. I mean, perhaps one could link this news with the attack that took place in Tunisia earlier in the year. And we are, in fact, witnessing the same phenomenon. These two parts of a border with Libya, and the fact that the factions which are fighting there are now creating a much more unstable political landscape than it already was. So, of course, it's good to see Tunisia stepping up to the effort, trying to appear to be doing its part in rescuing migrants, but of course, what is needed is a concerted effort throughout the northern coast of Africa, and that kind of unity seems to be more difficult to achieve.
Earlier on this year, Quentin, the EU was considering plans to outsource patrols of the Med to countries like Egypt and Tunisia. I think Donald Tusk and Federica Mogherini were either going or intending to go to Tunisia. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the problem is that their resources are just so slight. They don't have the resources to do this. And what's happening here is that you have got hundreds of thousands of potential migrants who've built up, particularly in Libya, trying to get across the Mediterranean. And any miserable little fishing boat is just commandeered, they're stuck on it, and the people who stick them on it, the people traffickers, don't care if they sink or can't swim or whatever. Now, we were very, very hypocritical and about this. We, I say, certainly the British government, probably one of the worst, but many of the North European governments, in not wanting to help out, not wanting to help Italy to actually save these people, and then not wanting to take our share of these migrants. I think it's a very good reminder when we see something like this, that Tunisia is indeed, with its modest resources, doing its best. But the problem is going to be, just as Oscar said, that Libya is a failed state. No question. It has collapsed. And they're rushing through.
You also have the problem that Quentin was mentioning, these boats being piled high with people, often commandeered by Tunisian fishermen and Tunisian captains themselves. Yes. This is a situation whereby Tunisia also needs to look at itself in terms of the people who are responsible for the migration crisis.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this phenomenon, as I suggested before, has spread throughout North Africa. The stability that was created by the vacuum of power in Libya, and also, of course, the situation in Syria, is clearly overwhelming the countries of North Africa. The problem is that there are not enough resources. Tunisia is clearly trying to do its work because it is facing now not just a difficult neighbors and a porous border, but as you pointed out, they are also facing an internal problem. And then it becomes much more difficult to try and react properly.
Let's move finally on to a man who spent a good part of his professional life playing the undead. Today, Christopher Lee, at 93, died. He made his name in the brilliant Hammer horror films, but he also is the excellent baddie Scaramanga in The Man with the Golden Gun. He said he was going to die with his boots on, and he almost did, as before he fell ill, he was preparing for his next screen role opposite Uma Thurman. Quentin, when someone is a figure as large as Christopher Lee goes, everybody says, oh, isn't it dreadful, because cinema isn't what it is now in terms of the subtlety that the likes of Christopher Lee brought to the screen, and the fact that he was a man who could define a genre.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was that subtle, but he was wonderful in his role. And as I just discovered, I didn't realise his mother actually was a sort of Italian aristocrat. So there was clearly more than a flash of sort of Mediterranean romance to him. And he was wonderful in those roles. But, you know, there was an awful lot of the hamming it up in Hammer films, so it wasn't that subtle.
Oscar, growing up not in Britain, I would imagine, how far did Christopher Lee travel?
Oh, huge. He was huge in Latin America. Vincent Price and Christopher Lee were the voices of horror for not only for my generation, but certainly younger ones. They did define the genre in a way that perhaps is not possible nowadays. And yet, you know, even my nephews and my daughter, who's now 14, I was talking to her this morning, and she mentioned, oh, he promised to die with his boots on. Well, he must have died with his Sauron boots on.
And to what degree did we see South American actors suddenly want to be Christopher Lee? Because I think lots of people sort of imagine that horror stayed Anglophone, and, you know, spin-offs like Amicus and what have you. But, you know, were there lots of little Oscars running around with fangs?
Actually, there is a huge and important tradition of horror, particularly in Mexican cinema. And there were, two-way borrowings in between the British horror industry and the Mexican horror industry. The Mexican horror industry, for instance, benefited from the early contribution of surrealist filmmakers when they made it there from Spain. You know, Luis Buñuel, for instance, those dreamscape scenes of his in Obscured Subject of Desire and others became part of horror, and they were also taken by Hammer films. So,
gentlemen, I'm afraid we have to leave it there as sales of garlic and wooden stakes plummet tonight. Quentin Peele and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both, gentlemen, for joining me in the studio. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks to our producers, Tom Hall and Marcus Hippie, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariana Zuniga, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond, too. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. And then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And then at 2200, 100 Hours is a Monocle Daily. Myself here in London, Thomas Lewis in our Toronto bureau will be co-hosting across the Atlantic. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 Hours London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Emma Nelson, and thank you very much indeed for listening.